Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. I'd like to welcome our audience live here in San Francisco and our audiences online and on the radio. And we invite you to visit us at www.commonwealthclub.org. At any time, you can hear recordings of our lectures. It's my great pleasure to introduce Bill Issel tonight, who is going to be speaking on the second in a trilogy that he's working on the history of church and state in San Francisco. Bill Issel is a professor of history emeritus at San Francisco State University and the visiting professor of history at Mills College. The first book in this series was For Both Cross and Flag, Catholic Action, Anti-Catholicism, and National Security Politics in World War II San Francisco. Now, this covers the post period of time, all through the 50s and 60s, basically, and Bill's working on a third book in the series, which will cover from the mid-time all the way through the 90s, right? So, it's our great pleasure to hear about how cities get argued over by the different major groups that are in it. Thank you very much, Bill.
Thanks very much, George. And thanks to all of you for coming out on this Monday. How y'all doing? All right? Okay. So, this all started when I talked to another historian at a history meeting, a guy named David Kurtzer, who had just come out with a book about Pope Pius XI and Mussolini. That particular pope is known as the Pope of Catholic Action, a 20th century phenomenon. And so, since David was doing a book talk here at the Commonwealth Club, I got in touch with George and said, how about a book on Catholic action from the grassroots in the Bay Area, especially San Francisco? So that's how this got started. George suggested that since the club was doing something on LGBT issues in August, that my book could maybe fit into that. And I said, it's a natural, because my story is a kind of backstory to the city's response to the LGBT movement in San Francisco. So that's where I'm going. Way to think about my book in relation to LGBT issues is to consider it as a complement to the four books you see on the screen here that have come out in the last 10 years. They're terrific books. Together, they do a good job of providing a sort of basics for the LGBT movement from the standpoint of the movement. Now, my book has to do with a context, and let's get right into it. As we all know, San Franciscans have a sort of worldwide reputation as a place where people demand the right to the city in order to participate in defining the public interest or the common good. In a sort of refashioning of this concept, in a book that he published last year, David Harvey, who has been associated with this concept since the 70s, has put it this way, that the right to the city is an empty signifier. You've got to fill it up with content. And that comes as a result of struggle and conflict. Now, a lot of people who are familiar with the concept, some who even teach it and write about it here and in Europe, associate the notion of the right to the city with socioeconomic issues and contests over social justice and economic justice. The picture you see on the left is from the Common Sense newspaper that was published by the Northern California Alliance that was active in district election for supervisors campaigns. And that's a picture of an article that I did with one of my students. In the early 70s, here in France and in England especially, the notion of the right to the city was being written about and practiced by people who were active in issues of social and economic justice, including redoing the structure of urban governance in order to maximize the possibility of socioeconomic justice. The poster is from one of those campaigns also. So the right to the city also pertains to contests over a variety of issues beyond socioeconomic ones. On the left, we have the 1977 Gay Freedom Day Parade. Dick LaGates and I were there together, I recall. And on the right is Phyllis Schlafly, famously or infamously associated with the Eagle Forum, a Roman Catholic and non-Roman Catholic activity. But if we go all the way back to the 1890s, we'll see that Catholics were demanding the right to the city in order to participate in defining the common good. And I begin my book with a revisiting of the story of this particular priest, Father Peter York, and his insistence that the city charter, the basic framework of governance, be written so as not to exclude Catholics in any way. I go through the book in a roughly chronological order. It fixes itself, thanks. Telling the story of the transmittal of this Roman Vatican concept of Catholic action from Rome to San Francisco. As Moa Faye Symington put it, we need to bring the Spirit of Christ into the environment in which we live and where we function. And so the bottom line of the book is that reconsidering San Francisco history in the 20th century leads us to conclude that certainly business power shaped the city. And so did the power of organized labor. And my book tells a story that has not been told so far about how Catholic values and the institutional Catholic Church strongly influenced the agendas of both organized labor and organized business. Michael Casey, who had a long political career from the 1890s right through the middle of the 1930s, including playing a role in the 1934 waterfront and general strike, and Frederick Koster, a local businessman who was active not only in the Bay Area but also statewide. Their stories make up part of the material of the book. The Pope used all the modern technology available to him to participate in a transnational contest for the hearts and minds of men, women, and children, not only in the United States, but elsewhere. Here he is in a St. Patrick's Day radio message to the people of Ireland. Here in San Francisco, Catholic men and women, their names are largely forgotten today, were involved in a daily basis in shaping not only public policy, but also the policies of private institutions of all sorts. From the mayor, Angelo Rossi, who, contrary to the conventional historical wisdom, was not a nobody, but a very active Catholic, and was responsible also for bringing the city into Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal order, despite the fact that he never changed his voting registration from Republican to Democrat. Agnes Gertrude Reagan, active not only in San Francisco, she was part of the Tobin banking family, but also active nationally as the executive secretary of the National Catholic Welfare Council, the forerunner of today's U.S. Conference of Bishops. Now, San Francisco was also, and this is one of those historical contingencies that historians love to explore, it was also a specifically targeted place by the Kremlin because of its role as the important port north of Los Angeles on the West Coast. From the standpoint of the Kremlin, the next war, this is in the early 30s, was going to be a war between the capitalists allied against the Soviets. And so you needed to plan ahead and make sure that you had supporters in all the major ports. So when the war started between the capitalists and the communists, there would be Communist Party cadre in all the major ports, and the ports would be shut down, and the war would come to a grinding halt long enough for the Soviet Union to maintain its integrity and independence. Like the Catholic Action leaders, the Communist Party leaders have been mostly forgotten. I was lucky, you know, the Paul Simon song, Born at the Right Time. I was born at the right time, so I got to meet Elaine Black and Carl Yaneda and David Jenkins. They were all dedicated to the future success of the Soviet experiment, not only in the Soviet Union, but also in the United States. And the result of these two transnational contests was that the 1930s was a decade of robust contests, not only in the Bay Area, of course, but elsewhere, including in the 1934 waterfront strike and general strike. Communist Party used its May Day parades to exercise moral authority and to get across its message. The Catholics in San Francisco used parades and also these mass public meetings like this one at the old Seal Stadium. From the standpoint of the Communist Party, the Catholics were in league with the devil in undoing a elected government in Spain. From the standpoint of the Catholic activists, the world was entering a period of darkness as a result of the failure of secular Americans and people of other countries, socialists, anarchists, communists, who had turned away from Christ the King. And so the world was going to hell. Beginning in the 1930s, Catholic Action shaped an entire generation of men and women who would play leadership roles in the city in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s. Joe Alioto began his public career with a speech at the Catholic Young Men's Institute. He called it the Catholic Internacional. We need it, he said, in order to counter the Communist Internacional. This was a program, Catholic Action, not restricted to men. It was also a women's program, and it was also a program, as I detail in the book, that recruited children from not only the Catholic schools, but also outside the Catholic schools among children who were baptized Catholics. And so in a very real way, San Francisco was a front in a culture war. There were many. The well-known New York conflicts have also generated several books. But I try to tell the story in my book of how this war developed, who was involved, as we move from the 30s into the 1940s. Census takers declared San Francisco the fourth, the 12th largest city in 1940. And it's hard for us to imagine walking the streets of San Francisco today. But there was a time in my lifetime when more than 9 out of 10 San Franciscans were white, and either immigrants, the children of immigrants, or the grandchildren of immigrants from these countries. So it's not surprising that my friend and late friend Kevin Mullen, former deputy chief of the SFPD and author of several books, in his memoir wrote that it was in the Army that for the first time in my life I had anything to do with people who were not Catholic and not mostly of Irish background. Well, he's 5 years older than me, but a good deal of that, you know, was familiar to me in growing up. We have to remember also that in 1940 and until after World War II, the Asian populations and the African American populations were very small in absolute terms and in terms of today's numbers and proportions also. The what we call today Latino or Hispanic population between 1 and 2% about this time. But as Kevin put in his memoir, unbeknownst to us, things were changing. My own personal life, I experienced that change. I grew up and went to school in the first, five grades, kindergarten and 1 through 5, in Fremont School, built in 1892. And my fifth grade teacher, Mrs. Jacobson, when she wanted us to get in line and, you know, shape up and be aware of how lucky we were, would say this: our class is like a little United Nations. That's me in the middle of the back row. Well, the population was changing, and so was the political agenda of San Franciscans in response to local, national, and international events. This is the first march on Market Street that I have a personal memory of. This is 1946. There's a protest against lynching in Georgia. And as I was going through grammar school, transferred to St. Agnes, and then to St. Amedia School, Catholic principles were being strongly imported into the operation of the San Francisco Democratic Party. And more former Republicans were changing their registration and voting Democrat, including large numbers of San Francisco Catholic voters who moved from the Republican category to the Democrat category, until some of them, like my late father, moved back to the Republican category, much to my chagrin and our shouting matches in the age of Reagan. Catholic Action also financed refugee resettlement. This was a reception for newly arrived refugees from the Soviet bust of the Hungarian Revolution. And Catholic Action also backed fair employment practice legislation and also opposed strongly laissez-faire economics, turning the clock back to the pre-National Labor Relations Board years before 1935. And I have two chapters in the book that go into this story. Catholic Action also joined with Jewish activists in San Francisco in support of racial liberalism, the kind of racial reforms that were characteristic of the period before the passage of the Voting Rights Act, before Black Power, and so on. Another type of social diversity was taking place in San Francisco also. I went to work as a clerk in the Southern Pacific Company, moved from construction to working as a clerk and starting to think about going to college again. In 1958, I met a number of, turned out to be friends, who worked in the same department, the Treasury Department and the Southern Pacific. They put me into the knowledge. They said, you know, there's a big sign on top of the building. It says SP. You think, and a lot of people think it means Southern Pacific. It doesn't. It stands for Swish Palace. Stanley Hilden, who died in 1991, a good friend of mine, moved to San Francisco from Wisconsin, where he grew up in a good Danish Protestant family. And as Martin Meeker points out, quotes this letter in his book, Contacts Desired, there were a lot of people writing to Martin and Lyon in the 50s with these kinds of letters. I think I should like living in San Francisco. The aggressive public morals campaign that a lot of us know about and associate with Tom Cahill and with William Hanrahan, who was responsible for what some still regard as a witch hunt against Lawrence Ferlinghetti. They were part of a program, Catholic Action Program, that began in the 1930s. They were part of a 1950s chapter of that Catholic Action Program. Harold McKinnon, who was one of the founders of the Catholic Men of San Francisco, along with Sylvester Andriano, who was on the police commission, was George Christopher's police commissioner. So this is why I say the material in my book provides a kind of backstory to the actual conflicts that will occur when people like Cahill and Hanrahan and hundreds of their fellow Catholic Action activists and their children regarded Howell, I won't quote it for you, I do it in class, but I won't do it here. We all know it, right? Especially in the poets. Now, we also know that in the 60s and 70s, Catholics here and elsewhere responded to both national events that were happening within the Catholic Church and international events, such as Griswold v. Connecticut and subsequent cases. Griswold didn't go very far, did it? It allowed you, if you were a gynecologist, to prescribe birth control information and techniques to your married patients, but not your unmarried patients. And not in Rhode Island. Connecticut, yes, not Rhode Island. Not until Griswold. And the result, very dramatic. Church attendance fell off almost immediately. I can speak to that personally. and huge hemorrhaging of priests from the Catholic Church. 3,000 men. What does that mean? 3,000 men resigned during this period. That's about 5% of the priests in the U.S., folks. And then, as we know, San Francisco becomes an international destination for men and women from all over. And as Chris Carlson puts it in his newest book, 10 Years That Shook the City, a nice collection of essays, they came with a rebellious, anti-authoritarian sensibility. They did not come to attend Mass at the new cathedral on Peter York Way. Joe Alioto distinguished himself from many of his Catholic Action veterans from the 30s by taking a kind of come what may, live and let live approach in contrast to George Christopher, who was not a Catholic, or Christopher's police commissioner, Harold McKinnon. But Alioto, and I'll say more about this in the next book to come in this series, Alioto was sort of last of a era. And the era of Catholic-inflected New Deal-ism in San Francisco was pretty much on the way out in the 1970s. By the beginning of the 1980s, when the Archbishop commissioned this report of a task force on gay lesbian issues, it was already clear that the church was facing substantial challenges from within and from without. Read Donal Godfrey's book on Most Holy Redeemer Church for an insight to how that developed in one particular parish. And since then, of course, the church has been praised for its support of racial liberalism and socioeconomic liberalism, and condemned for its opposition to contraception, to abortion, to the public policy agenda generally of the LGBT freedom movement, and including, of course, same-sex marriage. Now, I've been pleased with the reviews so far. Carol McKimmon from Stanford particularly pleased me when I read her review. But I'm not arguing that we should overturn previous interpretations of San Francisco history. Certainly the case that, to use the title of my San Francisco State colleague, Rich DeLeon, the notion that San Francisco was a left coast city is a notion that continues to attract our respect. Similarly, the title that Josh Sides used for his book, Erotic City. Josh is the son of a former colleague at San Francisco State, Sudie Sides, intergenerational professional transmission there. Certainly, we need to take into account. And my point is that we also need to take into account this Catholic campaign. One of the most successful, certainly one of the most robust in the country, to bring these Vatican ideas across the Atlantic and to make them part of an agenda for public policy and the policy of private institutions outside the Catholic Church. The next assignment, of course, is how to define and enhance the freedoms of an open society in conditions of growing diversity such as we experience here and as other Americans in other metropolitan areas experience across the country. And of course, this is not simply a U.S. Issue, is it? Hardly. Now, sometimes in these book talks, people ask me, how did you get interested in this? And my answer is I had the motive, the means, and the opportunity. The motive went all the way back to when I was a little kid and delivering the $10 bill to our landlady, Mrs. Cap, for our rent on our cottage in the back of her lot near the corner of Baker and McAllister Streets. Mrs. Cap had come from Wisconsin, another migrant to San Francisco, married Mr. Cap, who was one of the main property developers in the Mission District. And as her four children grew up, she accumulated this wonderful library, which she still had when I was bringing the rent over. So I would bring over the rent. She would give me some milk and cookies and let me come in the library and look at her books. It was wonderful. I won't go into much detail, but she told me stories about her husband, who was the jury foreman in the famous Graff trial of that convicted Abraham Roof and Eugene Schmitz. Roof ended up serving time in San Quentin. Schmitz got out on a technicality, but that's another story. Growing up in a German-American Catholic family, pretty much headed by my grandma, Teresa, I was sort of picked out to be the person who was going to be the family priest. Well, that never happened. But I got, you know, told all of these stories. So Mrs. Cap read me from Jack London's stories about the oyster pirates and told me about the old days in San Francisco. And my grandma, Teresa, told me about how America was a paradise for Catholics. They didn't have to worry about the kind of persecution that her family members who stayed in Germany had to undergo during the Kulturkampf of Bismarck. Teresa's sons, my uncles, were all, with one exception, active in the Catholic inflected AFL and CIO union movement of the 30s and 40s and 50s. So that gave me another sort of take on these issues. And so did the nuns at St. Agnes School, especially Sister Bernadette Giles, who served 16 years on the city's Human Rights Commission. She was appointed by Jack Shelley and served a very active 16 years. And finally, the streets of San Francisco were as important in education to me as Fremont School, St. Agnes School, St. Emilia School, Reardon High, San Francisco State, Berkeley, University of Pennsylvania, etc. Because on the streets of San Francisco, I learned firsthand about contests over the right to the city, right? And I won't go into details, but I'll end instead with three questions for discussion that are centrally related to this book and to my three-book trilogy. And I'm also going to do a book that puts San Francisco in a national context with a specific comparison and contrast with Providence, Rhode Island, and Boston, Massachusetts. A year after this, I'm going to be for a year at Salve Regina University in Newport, partly so I can do the archival research that I've done here in San Francisco for Boston and for Providence. So these are the questions I'll leave us for discussion. They apply, of course, to not only San Francisco, but pretty much anywhere you go in the world today, where we have reopened these questions that in the 50s, some liberal political scientists thought it had been closed. In fact, as late as the 80s, we had the famous claim that modernity had won and history was over. Well, we know differently, don't we? Well, thank you very much. And I want to leave plenty of time for discussion and your questions.
Thank you very much. And I'd like to remind our audience online and on the radio that they're listening to Bill Issel speaking about church and state in the city of San Francisco, the history basically from the 40s, 50s, and 60s. Now it's time for questions. Who'd like to ask the first question?
I wish I were old enough to have been in all those places. I wanted to ask if the role of the new virulently anti-abortion and anti-gay rights Archbishop of San Francisco and his role in the campaigns and movements of the last few years towards gay marriage and gay rights in general in San Francisco.
The question is about the current Archbishop. Right? Corleone. Some of my Catholic friends call him Archbishop Corleone. It's a great question, and it emphasizes a point that I make throughout the book, and that is that Catholics don't think with one mind, vote according to a voting bloc, or interpret the so-called teachings of the Catholic Church in the same way. In fact, I just finished reading a book that I'm reviewing by a professor, Lawrence McAndrews, called What They Wished For. It's the first book to detail Catholics and every presidency from John Kennedy through Bush 2. Right? Doesn't include Obama. Archbishop Corleone is not unique. Bishops have, since the 19th century, taken relatively more aggressive, relatively less aggressive positions on particular formal edicts issued by the Pope. Take, for example, the one I showed in the slide, Humanae Vitae. One of the points that McAndrews makes in this new book, it's a great book, by the way, I recommend it strongly, it's published by University of Georgia Press in May. McAndrews points out that after the issuing of that surprise encyclical, why was it a surprise? Because the Pope's advisory commission had recommended that the Pope, quote, liberalize the church's teachings on, quote, non-natural forms of contraception. But the Pope saw fit to ignore the advisory committee's advice and instead published a robust defense of a 19th century, right, approach to contraception. So my sort of, I don't mean this to be glib, but when it comes to particular archbishops, my answer is similar to the answer to the tourist in San Francisco who says, is the weather always like this in August? And you say, well, just wait for a while, it'll change.
Thanks so much for your presentation. I really want to focus in on the LGBT issues.
Right.
Broadly, San Francisco's been known as the wide open city. And so how did the Catholic Church and this basically, I think it's more well known than its Catholic heritage. So how do Catholics and the wide open city philosophies coexist? But specifically, when you get to the 80s, the AIDS crisis was very morally complex, and so how did the church deal with the AIDS crisis?
That's a great question. First of all, the wide open city stereotype was always an exaggeration, always a hyperbole. And I attribute a good deal of it to a man I met when I was in school, Herb Cain. So Herb Cain publicized this notion that San Francisco had a reputation as a liberal place, liberal in the sense that anything goes. Or as I put it in the introduction to my book, that San Francisco is a place, maybe I should read it, but never mind. It's a place where anything goes and everybody's welcome no matter what they do. This was always untrue. As my friend and colleague Bob Cherney and I put it in a book we published on San Francisco between the Civil War and the 1930s, San Francisco, and this was true past the 30s into the 50s, San Francisco has always been a city with several populations in uneasy coexistence. And we pointed out in our earlier book, and I point out in this book, that San Francisco does not deserve to have a reputation as a tolerant place when it comes to radicalism, anarchism especially, or socialism or communism, or sexual experimentation or the living out of one's desire, no matter where it takes one. So this reputation was in fact one of the causes belli that the Catholic Action leaders, both in the institutional church and the men and women and students in grammar schools and high schools, regarded as a rallying cry. So when Life magazine published to the world that San Francisco was the gay capital, these were fighting words. The problem for the Catholic Church and for Catholics who wanted to maintain the city as a expression of that ideology was that it was too late, right? It was too late. By the time SP came to stand for Swish Palace, to a greater extent than Southern Pacific, it was too late. And so the Catholic Church and defenders among Catholics who took that position were on the defensive, and they have been ever since. And you can see that in election after election. And in the next book I'm going to do, from covers the time from the election of Jack Shelley through the end of the term of Archbishop Quinn, you can see that over and over and over again. Now, with regard to the AIDS crisis, Donnell Godfrey's book, I was hoping he would be here. I haven't met him. He said he might be here, but I don't think he's here. I just know his picture from online. We had email conversations. But his book does a very good job of showing the divisions within the San Francisco church as some priests began to try to practice their Catholic Christianity with regard to those suffering from AIDS. And the, from my point of view, certainly the incomplete and, you know, much too passive and and not aggressive enough. This has to do, again, with the diversity that exists within the Catholic lay community and within the Catholic clerical community and among the bishops of the church. It was a change in the pastor of Most Holy Redeemer Church that resulted in, finally, Most Holy Redeemer moving in a different way. So it's very complicated. The Catholic Church is this huge institution, which, despite the fact that it became more centralized after the Pius IX's term and became more and more centralized in the 20th century, it still is highly decentralized. And even among the bishops, we all remember, I think, the 2004 election when most Catholics voted not for the Catholic candidate, John Kerry, but for the Methodist / evangelical candidate, George W. Bush. Right? Most of the polls that were done indicated that about 3/4 of Catholic voters did not know John Kerry was Catholic. And some of you may remember John Kerry sort of flip-flopping on the whole issue of abortion and access to abortion rights and partial birth abortion, which was still a issue in the courts in 2004. It wasn't until 2007 that the Supreme Court approved the ban on so-called partial birth abortions, or what are they called, IDE, stands for intact dilation and evacuation, right? Does that help?
My question is more within the period of the book, but similar to Sue's, in that it has to do with the political connection or contest between organized LGBT groups and the Catholic Church.
Right.
The Council on Religion and the Homosexual, which was formed based out of Glide Memorial Church by a number of homophile activists and clergy, was formed, according to an interview I just saw with Del Martin and Phyllis Lyons, because John Burton had recommended that they needed to get the clergy involved if they were going to overturn sodomy laws, that there was an explicitly political move.
Right.
So as I've looked at material about Council on Religion and the Homosexual, I have not seen much about whether they, what kinds of contacts or arguments they had with the Catholic Church in San Francisco.
Right. That's a great question. And the short answer is that when the council was formed, the Catholic Church was still considering Jews to be the enemy, and Catholic priests were, generally speaking, refused permission to attend meetings in Protestant churches or Jewish synagogues. So the ecumenism, which has, in relative terms, become more practiced by the Catholic Church and by Catholics up to today, it was still unborn. I have gone through the Catholic archives looking for any correspondence to and from the Archbishop's office, to the Chancery office, to the Chancellor, about the Council. And I know that both Chris Agee and Josh Sides were interested in these topics also. But the Catholic Church was not involved. And the reason is partly that the Archbishop, until 1961, was Archbishop Mitty, who was, in today's terms, you know, these terms, liberal and conservative, they don't really work with the Catholic Church and with lay Catholics because of reasons that we're all familiar with. But let's say to liberalize the church's approach to ecumenical meetings, programs, campaigns, was still far in the future, right? So it would be much later that the church would approve these kinds of things, even as late as the campaign against the so-called right to work ballot measure in 1958. Even then, the Archbishop was refusing permission to the local so-called labor priests to work publicly in connection with Protestant and Jewish religious activists on the side of the labor movement.
Thank you again for your talk. I'm just wondering if the, well, there's so many other factors involved in the decline of labor unions, but
sure.
Has the church, do you feel the church has played any role in that decline? Have they defended unions, or are they less likely to now? Does it make any difference?
Oh, that's another great question. So far, nobody's written this book, but it really needs to be written because, and in fact, I'll just lift a phrase from this book that I just read and I'm reviewing by Lawrence McAndrews. McAndrews puts it this way, that many Catholics left behind their immigrant political machine origin agenda as they moved from places like Queens and Brooklyn, upstate New York, destinations like Hastings on the Hudson, or as they moved from the Mission District in San Francisco to Daly City or to Moraga and Orinda. And they began voting or Republicans, not Democrats, and they began criticizing if they had pastors who were presenting homilies about the need to support the organizing of the unorganized, right? Battle cries for the union movement from the 60s to the present. Then they asked the priest to stop being political in the public, in the pulpit. These were issues best left to the market. Yeah. So it's complex. And, of course, the answer differs from place to place depending on the particular priest involved and so forth.
You mentioned Boston.
Yeah.
And even though you haven't done the research, you must have picked Boston for a reason. And maybe you have some ideas at this point what made these relatively similar cities have similarities, differences, and I wondered if you thought about that at this point.
I've given a lot of thought. Haven't done the research, as you say, but my position is in disagreement with Charles Morris, who in his book about American Catholics, published about 15 years ago, characterizes San Francisco as Boston on the Pacific. Nope. Boston is different, partly because the population was different. Partly because Boston Catholics arrived after Boston had already been enshrined as the capital of Puritan propriety and good manners and culture. So Catholics in Boston operated with a siege mentality, and they were different people from different parts of Europe. And the story also is different because of the particular bishops in Boston. You know, there's a wonderful book by federal court Judge Noonan, who begins his book with a personal sort of remembrance of the archbishop whose name I'm blanking out right now. All I can think of is Curley, but that was the mayor, sorry. Anyway, so the population differences, the personality differences of the bishops, the fact that Catholics came to San Francisco and, like all of those Jews who came from a couple of villages in Bavaria. I'm forgetting the name of the most important one. Reckendorf. The Reckendorfers, right? The Levi Strauss and a bunch of others came from that same village, right? They came to San Francisco and made it their city. There was no pre-existing Protestant establishment to grind them under the heel. And so Catholics in San Francisco called San Francisco our city. The same way, and Irina Narell used this title in her book about San Francisco Jews, our town. And even the relationship between Catholics and Jews in San Francisco was different than the relationship between Catholic and Jews in Boston. And in 19, I point out in the book, Archbishop Hanna received the annual Merit Award from the American Jewish Committee for doing the most of any person in the year, I think it was 1933, to facilitate comity between Catholics and Jews. And in the local Catholic newspaper, the editor bragged about how we Catholics in San Francisco do things differently, which helps explain why, not a month after Kristallnacht in November of 1938, the Archbishop from San Francisco organized with Catholic University a nationwide radio program putting Catholics on the record as being in solidarity with Jews in Germany and being opposed to this kind of racist, Goldhagen calls eliminationist racism in Germany. Yeah. But come and ask me after I do the Boston research.
Right, we have time for one more question.
Just looking around the city, you can see remnants of what must have been a large, large organization. Lots of big church buildings, lots of other associated buildings that are now either very half full or empty and completely abandoned. Right. So it's real evident that they've left the building. In other words, they've moved to the East Bay or they've moved to south of here. My question has to do with, given all that, what is the present Catholic Church doing today within the city to, I don't know, city government and also the LGBT issues?
That's a good question. It's a huge subject of debate, I understand, within the local Catholic Church. To some extent, you can see the response in the way that the church is attempting to increase its publicity about Catholic points of view. By using an online newspaper called Now Catholic San Francisco, by a television program, by a radio program. But to some extent, this is in a sort of uncharted territory for the church. Because since 2002, Catholics in the Bay Area, Catholic laity I'm talking about, like Catholics all over the country, are responding very aggressively to the horrific uncovering of the scandalous behavior of over 11,000 Catholic priests, including a number of bishops, including such people as Rembert Wakeland of Minneapolis, who was the chief architect of one of the best-known, most, quote, progressive in San Francisco terms, economic documents of the Reagan era, the 1986 U.S. Bishop's Statement about Economic Justice. Over 11,000 priests, and in 95% of the Catholic dioceses of the United States. So these questions of, you know, how to regain the initiative and, you know, revitalize the church, they're at the top of the agenda of the National Bishops Organization. In fact, some of the bishops, in my understanding, some of the bishops in the last several years have been pushing in the U.S. Conference of Bishops for more attention to revitalizing U.S. Catholicism and less attention on issues of abortion rights and same-sex marriage and so forth. But how this works out, I can't tell you. But you can see this in the local controversies over, for example, the shrine at St. Francis of Assisi Church and the debate about that, debate about what to do with the seminary, which is, you walk the halls of the seminary, which is where the archives are located, and it's like walking through a building in a ghost town. And almost all the seminarians are from the Philippines or from other Pacific Islands or from other continents, not from the U.S. So that's a great question. I don't have much of an answer, I'm afraid.
And that was a great lecture. And it was a great ending to it because you are a historian, not a seer of the future. So, but that's obviously why we all study history, to see where the trends are going. So thank you very much, Bill.
Thank you.
Great lecture. Thank you. I'm sure Bill's book is available for sale, and I'm sure he'd be willing to talk to you afterwards if you have any other questions. I know there are a few more that didn't get in the hour that we have. But so ends another event of the Commonwealth Club in its 112th year of enlightened discussion.